Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's a truism. Other than the old elements themselves, earth, wind, water, fire, no force is more powerful than humankind. Historian Yuval Noah Harari says Homo sapiens became central, powerful, because of our capacity for myth-making, for weaving stories that help us work together for big goals. And now we are riding on the backs of our myths into a future where we will become a very different kind of animal machine, he says. It's a wild vision this hour on Point. Homo sapiens, us, the great storytellers, and where our stories are taking us. Joining me now from New York is Yuval Noah Harari, professor of world history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. The U.S. edition of his book is out tomorrow. It's being translated into 28 languages. It's been a bestseller in Israel. The Financial Times named it one of the best books of 2014. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Yuval, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
We were not alone in the race to become the Homo this or Homo that that would be dominant. Why our strand? Why, rather than Neanderthals or anybody else?
Well, if you go back 100,000 years, you indeed find the planet populated by many different kind of humans. And it's strange to think about it because we are used to being the only humans around. We think that humans come basically just in one flavor. But when you look at the rest of the animal kingdom, you find that most animals have different species. So why not humans? And this indeed was the case 100,000 years ago. If you want to understand what makes us so different, then I think the best answer we have is that we are the only ones, not only from the human species, but from all the animals on the planet that can cooperate flexibly in large numbers. And we can do that because of our unique capacity for storytelling and myth-making.
When you describe storytelling and myth-making, you don't just mean fairy tales. You mean what we've come to accept as many fundamental elements of human life. Lay some of those out.
Yes, basically, if you examine any large-scale human cooperation, you will always find some fiction or some myth at its basis. It's easiest to understand, say, in the religious field, where people cooperate because of their belief in religious stories. You can never convince, say, a chimpanzee to do something for you by promising him that after you die, if you do this, you will go to chimpanzee heaven and there you will receive lots of bananas for your good deeds here on earth. So now do what I tell you to do. No chimpanzee will ever believe such a story, which is why chimpanzees don't build cathedrals, don't go on crusades, don't go on jihads. But humans do believe such stories, and this is what enables complete strangers to come together and build cathedrals or hospitals and go on jihads or crusades. And we find the same thing in many other spheres of activity. For instance, in the economic sphere, perhaps the most successful story ever told by humans is the story of money. Money is just a fiction in our own mind. If you take a dollar bill, you cannot eat it, you cannot drink it, you can't do anything with it. It has no intrinsic real value. But as long as many people believe that it has value, when you have these master storytellers, the chairman of the Federal Reserve or the president of the United States, they come to millions of people and they say, look, you see this piece of paper, it is actually worth 10 bananas. And if everybody believes it, it works. You can actually take this worthless piece of paper, go to a complete stranger, give it to him, and receive in exchange 10 bananas. This is something you can never do with a chimpanzee. Chimpanzees do trade. You can give, okay, I'll give you one banana, you give me a coconut. This is something chimpanzees can do. But you give me a worthless piece of paper, and I give you 10 real tasty bananas. This happens only with humans.
So it's not just cognitive capacity, though that's very important in your telling of this story, but it's the application of that cognitive capacity to these high concept ideas like corporations or money, or you can go right on down the line. You're saying that set Homo sapiens apart.
Yes, because what we need to understand is that cognitive abilities by themselves, they are nice, but they won't take you far. If you take me, for example, and a chimpanzee, and compare us one versus one, then you will find that despite all my wonderful cognitive abilities, I'm embarrassingly similar to a chimpanzee. And if you place both of us alone on some remote island, and we had to struggle for survival, I would definitely put my bets on the chimpanzee, not on myself. So one-on-one, even 10-on-10, we are not much better than chimpanzees. You begin to see the big differences only when you look at the large scale, when you take thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, compare them with tens of thousands of chimpanzees. If, for example, you take 100,000 chimpanzees and cram them together into Yankee Stadium, or into Wall Street, you will get complete chaos, utter chaos, because 100,000 chimpanzees cannot cooperate in any effective way. But you take 100,000 humans, and provided they all believe in the same stories, in the same myth about God or about human rights or about money, and you get extremely sophisticated networks of cooperation, which is what made us, and not the chimpanzees, the rulers of the world. Because again, if you look at all the big achievements of humankind, reaching the moon or splitting the atom or whatever, it's never the project of a single individual, it's always the project of many, many strangers coming together and pulling their strength and their cognitive abilities together.
Take us back to when Homo sapiens was not the only species under this genus of Homo on the planet. These other proto-humans were around. Did they not have the cognitive, the conceptual, the collaborative capacity of Homo sapiens?
As far as we know, some of them, like the Neanderthals, actually had bigger brains than our brains, but they couldn't cooperate on a large scale. If, for example, you examine archaeological remains from 50,000 years ago, you find that Neanderthals never traded. All the things that you find in a Neanderthal camp from, say, 50,000 years ago are local materials. But in contrast, when you excavate and when you find a sapiens camp, you sometimes find objects or materials which were brought from far off. For example, you have sites in Central Europe where you find seashells from the Atlantic or Mediterranean coast, which means that there was trade. So strangers cooperated with one another on the economic basis. And this is probably what gave sapiens an edge over Neanderthals, because again, one-on-one, the Neanderthals were probably as good, if not better, than us, but 500 sapiens against 50 Neanderthals, the 500 sapiens won. And it's one of the greatest what-ifs of history to think what would have happened if somehow the Neanderthals or one of the other species had managed to survive alongside us. So that today in the world, say in the United States, besides all the differences between people from different ethnic backgrounds, from different genders, from different classes, you also had this fundamental difference between sapiens and Neanderthals. What kind of politics, what kind of society, what kind of religion we would have, this is a fascinating issue.
Of course, some did interbreed. Little bits are still among us, woven into our genetic inheritance, I guess. There's a lot I want to look at between then and now, but bring us right up to date for just a moment before our first break here, Yuval. You say that we may now be in the last couple of hundred years of this long run of Homo sapiens, as we know, that Homo sapiens may come to an end, go on and evolve into something else, not Homo sapiens. What?
Well, it seems, I think, quite likely, given the current pace of technological development, especially in fields like biotechnology and computer science, that we will still have grandchildren, but I'm not so sure that our grandchildren will have grandchildren of their own, at least not human ones. I think it's very likely that within, say, 100 or 200 years, Homo sapiens will disappear. not by destroying ourselves in some nuclear catastrophe, but by upgrading ourselves into something completely different, something which is much more different from us than we are different from Neanderthals or chimpanzees, something that maybe the best epithet for is gods. I think we are in the process of upgrading ourselves into gods, and I mean this literally, not metaphorically. We are acquiring abilities which were traditionally considered to be divine abilities. To give just two examples, in the book of Genesis, God creates animals and plants and humans according to his wishes. We are now acquiring the technology to start creating and changing animals and plants and microorganisms and humans according to our wishes. Secondly, a second very central attribute of gods in almost all mythologies is that gods are immortal. And I think that in the 21st century, and more scientists are speaking about it openly, the big project of science and of humankind would be to try and defeat old age and death and give humans maybe not immortality, but at least indefinite lifespans.
It's pretty breathtaking. Do your colleagues look at you and say, yeah, Yuval, or do they look at you and say, are you nuts?
Depending which colleagues you have in mind.
I know Ray Kurzweil at Google, head of engineering there. He's very big on this. They call it singularity, sort of a machine-human merger. Yuval Noah Harari writes about it quite spectacularly in his new book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. It goes way back, millions of years, and then just a couple of hundred years ahead, says Homo sapiens may be done, or at least moved on. You all know Harari. Please stand by in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A little sound there from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Arthur C. Clarke, of course, wrote the story of, well, bones turned into weapons by apes and everything that followed. Yuval Noah Harari, in his new book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, is writing about a great sweep of time, the rise of Homo sapiens from all the other strands of life on Earth, including other proto-humans, to dominance. What it was in the nature of Homo sapiens that made that possible, and where our species may be headed next and soon, he says. Can you explain, Yuval, or take us back for this sapiens as the one super open to story, that capacity for myth-making, you say, or believing in large concepts or fictions, as you call them, that allowed them to go ahead? Did the other proto-humans have that capacity as well? Do we know?
We don't have any evidence to support it. And when we look at other animals, we don't see that they have anything like it, like the ability to invent and believe in things like gods or things like money or things like human rights, which we often take to be the truth, but in fact exist only in our own imagination. Just think about, say, our legal system without human rights. But then where are these human rights? They are not a biological reality. Just as chimpanzees or dolphins or wolves have no rights, so humans also have no rights. You cut open a human, you find inside the liver, the kidneys, the heart, blood, etc., but you don't find any rights. The only place they exist is in our own imagination, in the stories that we have constructed over the generations and convinced ourselves to believe. And we don't find anything remotely similar among any of the other animals on the planet, as far as we know.
Of course, those stories are very powerful. We have made them a reality. There's plenty of money floating around. There are plenty of corporations and other kind of fiction, plenty of religion, plenty of talk about human rights. We turn these into realities in a world dominated by Homo sapiens.
Yes, what I mean to say is that they are not that they are lies and not that they are not important. They are the most important thing in the world today, are these fictions. The very survival of real things, like rivers, like forests, like animals, today depends on the decisions and wishes of entities like the World Bank, like corporations, like nations, that in fact exist only in our own imagination, which no other animals can see or touch or feel or smell.
Take us back to the first emergence of the fruit of this kind of buy-in to these big concepts or ideas. I mean, a bunch of Neanderthals could chase down some kind of mastodon and kill it for dinner. That was not beyond their capacity. Other animals can do that. Wolf packs can do that. Where in Homo sapiens history do you see the first evidence of these larger undertakings made possible by this hyper-openness to story?
I think the first big enterprise in Homo sapiens history, like the first big thing that sapiens did, which distinguished it from all the other animals, is the colonization of Australia about 45,000 years ago. Humans have existed for 2.5 million years, and during this period, they spread from Africa all over, from East Africa, all over the Old World, Africa, Europe, Asia. But they never reached America or Australia because they couldn't cross the sea and land barriers. And then 45,000 years ago, you see groups of sapiens sailing, probably in some watercraft, from what is today Indonesia to what is today Australia. They get used very quickly. They acclimatize themselves to the new environment. And within a few thousand years, they cause the extinction of 95% of all the big animals of Australia. If you look at the big animals of Australia 50,000 years ago, you find dozens of different species. And then fast forward a few thousand years, you have humans and just the big kangaroos, and that's it. All the others became extinct. This is the first big thing that sapiens does in its history. And if in some, I don't know, mysterious plague, all the humans have died 40,000 years ago, this would still have been our mark on evolution, the destruction of the Australian megafauna, of the big animals of Australia. And then the next big thing that our ancestors are doing is doing exactly the same thing, but on a much, much bigger scale in America, where humans, sapiens, reach about 15,000 years ago, 16,000 years ago, and within 2,000 years, about 70% of all the big animals of America becomes extinct. Already before the agricultural revolution, our ancestors, before building the first village, before ploughing the first wheat field, we have already managed to destroy, to drive to extinction, about 50% of the large mammals of the entire planet.
You are remarkably ambivalent about all this supremacy of Homo sapiens. You're particularly ambivalent about the agricultural revolution itself, which is often lauded as a sign of human achievement. What's the source of your ambivalence?
There are two sources. First, what it did to humans, and secondly, what it did to animals. With regard to humans, we tend to think about it as a great leap forward because all the big achievements of civilization are based on this foundation of agriculture. Without agriculture, there are no cities, no kingdoms, no empires, no modern states, nothing. But if you look at it not from the collective level, if you look at it from the individual level, you see that the life of the average person, the average peasant woman in ancient Egypt or ancient China was actually much harder than 20,000 years previously in the time of the hunter-gatherers. First of all, in terms of work, peasants had to work much harder than hunter-gatherers, and the work was more difficult and more boring. Our bodies and minds evolved for hundreds of thousands of years to run after gazelles or go to the forest and pick mushrooms. They did not evolve. They are not suited to digging canals or harvesting the corn or grinding the corn all day. Secondly, peasants had a much worse diet, where hunter-gatherers subsisted by eating dozens of different species of plants and animals that they hunted and gathered, and therefore they got all the vitamins and minerals they needed. Peasants usually subsisted by eating just one type of crop, like potatoes in South America or wheat in the Middle East, and therefore the nutrition was much poorer. And lastly, they suffered much more from exploitation because agriculture was also the basis for the appearance of powerful elites that exploited everybody else. So from the point of view of the individual, I think it's safe to say that even by the year, say, 1800, most people on the individual level lived worse life than 20,000 years earlier. Now, if you move to look at what it did to animals, the situation is even grimmer. If they ever did a contest, like an Olympic contest, who is the most miserable organism that ever existed on planet Earth, my guess is that the gold medal will go either to the domesticated cows or domesticated pigs or domesticated chickens. We have made their lives hell on Earth. And from their perspective, the agricultural revolution and agriculture in general may well be one of the worst crimes in history.
You're remarkably ambivalent about civilization overall, it seems to me. And you seem to look back when we were running around, I don't know, the savannah, as you say, running down gazelles and picking mushrooms and berries as the golden age of Homo sapiens. We had a couple million years, more or less, in that zone, and only 10 or 12,000 since the agricultural revolution.
Yes, of course, I don't want to idealize that era. It's not that everything was perfect. Obviously, there were problems, a lot of problems. There was violence. There was periods of famine and so forth. If you fell from a tree and broke your leg, this could be a death sentence. But again, you have to think about it in comparison. In comparison with the life of a Welsh coal miner in the 19th century, or in comparison with the life of a Chinese peasant, or even in comparison, say, with the life of the person who manufactured the shirt that I'm now wearing, living somewhere in Bangladesh, working for 10, 12 hours for a few cents an hour in some big factory in Bangladesh, I'm not sure that the life of the person who made the shirt that I'm wearing now is really better on the individual level in terms of happiness and suffering than the life of her great-great-great ancestor, a hunter-gatherer in the Brahmaputra Valley 20,000 years ago.
That's pretty wild. Yuval Noah Harari writes in Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, he writes, "Unfortunately, the Sapiens regime on Earth has so far produced little that we can be proud of." Big statement. He writes, "In the last few decades, we have at least made some real progress as far as the human condition is concerned, with the reduction of famine, plague, and war. Yet the situation of other animals is deteriorating more rapidly than ever before, and the improvement in the lot of humanity is too recent and fragile to be certain of." And just as we reach that fragile improvement, you say it's almost at an end. Walk us forward a little bit, or just look around us in the present tense. What is it that leads you to say, on this show today, you're saying within maybe 100 years, Homo sapiens will be history?
Yes, what we need to understand, we are not talking about an extermination of Homo sapiens. We are not talking about some Hollywood scenario of the robots rising to wipe us out. Mm-hmm. And we are not talking about a single revolution, like one day we wake up and that's it, no more sapiens. We are talking about a gradual process, but quite a quick process, that technological improvements, especially in two fields, biotechnology, things like genetic engineering, and on the other hand, computer science, and for example, direct brain-computer interfaces, will change our physical, our cognitive, and our emotional capabilities to such an extent that the beings that result from these changes will be more different from us than we are different from Neanderthals or chimpanzees. For thousands of years, there have been many revolutions in history, technological, economic, political, but one thing remained constant, and this is humans themselves. There is no essential difference between, say, you and me and people in ancient Egypt or people in the time of the agricultural revolution. But looking 100 years to the future, There will again be lots of economic and political revolutions and so forth, but the biggest revolution of all will be the revolution in humans. We are going to change not only our economy and our environment, we are going to change our bodies, our brains, and our minds, and it is already happening all around us in very, very fast. So it's not just a prediction to the future, it's already a reality in the present. I think when you look around, say, at the medical establishment, you're seeing that medicine is changing its goals. In the 20th century, the chief goal of medicine, which was accomplished very successfully, was to heal the sick. In the 21st century, the aim is no longer just to heal the sick. The aim is to upgrade the healthy. And upgrading the healthy, this is what will usher in the new era of Homo sapiens turning into superhumans or into gods.
Respond to this. Neil writes to us online, says, merge with machines? Sure, anything is possible, but it is far more likely, this listener writes, we will kill ourselves off by climate change and pollution and the daft idea that we are not connected and completely dependent on the rest of nature. We like to think we're in control of nature, Neil writes, that we're separate from the rest of life on the planet. That is the problem, and it could lead to humans going extinct. Respond, Yuval.
Well, I think the question is, who are we? We tend to think about the whole of humankind as a single entity with the single fate, a single future. But one of the possibilities, maybe dangers of the 21st century is the danger of speciation, of humankind or Homo sapiens splitting first into different biological castes and then maybe into, again, different species, where you have most people, most of the ordinary poor people remaining just Homo sapiens, but you have a small caste of very rich and powerful people upgrading themselves into superhumans or into gods. And the dangers of climate change, of environmental degradation and so forth, they are very real. They are immense. They put in danger the survival of most of humanity. But looking back at history, my guess is that if bad comes to worse, the upper crust of humanity will find itself some technological Noah's Ark that will save it from the flood that it has unleashed itself. And most people may drown in this flood, but the super powerful, the super rich will upgrade themselves into something that will enable them to survive in even that flood.
What a picture. I've been keeping our callers waiting. Cody in Gallatin, Tennessee. Cody, you're on the air with Yuval Noah Harari.
Yes. I noticed that nowadays we're getting closer to where we can colonize the galaxy, where go to different places like Mars, and I think evolving into machines would allow us to do that, so we wouldn't have one fate. We would, if depending on which happens first, we'd already most likely be out there.
Cody, do you believe we can have two fates on this planet? Do you buy the idea that some super high caste can sort of separate itself from the rest of drowning life and humanity and go on this planet?
I think, like he said, humans are definitely going to be outbred, and you're still going to have classes where, which is going to lead to the outbreeding of Homo sapiens, because you'll have the people in, I guess it was District 9 or whatever it is, where you had the sky cities and everything, or Elysium, I think, was the movie. That kind of concept of people living up there while the humans get outbred.
Cody, I appreciate your call. Yuval, it's such a dystopic vision you've got. There are lots of humans who sort of like the idea of a well-functioning big society, not melting down apocalyptically into class or Noah's Ark destructions. Not in the cards.
Well, it's just a possibility. We're just outlining possible scenarios, which we need to keep in mind. To balance that, I think we should also remember the immense achievements of humankind over the last few decades, few generations, in particular overcoming plague, hunger, and above all, war. People don't realize it, but we are living in the most peaceful era in history. And if we can overcome war, maybe there is no limit to what good we can do.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Homo sapiens, us, how we came to rule the world, and what comes next. Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari is with us, professor of world history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His book, a bestseller there and beyond, being translated into 28 languages, now getting a lot of attention. Just coming out in the United States tomorrow is Sapiens, a brief history of humankind. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Yuval, here's a listener who asks, what mysterious algorithms of the human mind would allow us to run simulation stories and visual interactive scenarios that allow us to perceive and weigh probable outcomes that lead to survival? Do we owe our place in the hierarchy of flesh to mirror neurons, grid neurons, a particular person's neurons? What made that possible, Yuval?
Well, the simple answer is that we don't know. One of the things I like most about science is that when you don't know something, it's okay to just say, mm-hmm. we don't know. Mm-hmm. We need to keep asking the questions. Our understanding of the human brain and of the human mind is still in its infancy. There have been immense advance over the last few decades, but we are still very, very far from understanding such unique and complex capabilities as are involved in the imagination. We don't know what is the big difference between our brain and the brain, say, of Neanderthals. We do know that Neanderthal brain was actually larger than ours. Even the brains of people who lived, of Homo sapiens, that lived 100,000 years ago, was actually larger than our brain today. Over the last 10,000 years, since the agricultural revolution, our brains have been shrinking on average because the individual needs to know less and less in order to survive. We become increasingly dependent on systems of cooperation, and therefore our individual abilities, we need less of them. What nevertheless makes it possible for many brains to connect, to create this interbrain net, which is the sapient society, we don't understand the neural mechanisms or the algorithms that make this possible.
Susan, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're on the air with Yuval Noah Harari. Susan, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I didn't hear what you just said, but my curiosity is about brain development. I was interested when you had mentioned earlier that technology is part of what was going to shift us out of sapiens. And I'm curious about how our brain has shifted over time. I think about a pre-modern brain where part of what our life was to observe the natural world looking for God's signs in the present moment as a way of defining what our life needed to be. Compared to how now, postmodern world, our brain has evolved or has developed, where culturally part of what we're doing is looking forward, looking actively with a different kind of link to the present time. And I have a curiosity if some of those shifts are equal to or similar to the kind of technological shift you're talking about.
Susan, may I ask you, does it make intuitive sense to you? You've always just saying that actually our brains are shrinking over large expanses of time, individual brains, but we're still empowered as a species by this kind of interbrain net of society and now technology. Does that make sense to you?
It does. And within that, I'm still curious about ways of perception and how much perception actually impacts that. Like literally the way in which I understand and know myself as a person in relationship to the environment around me. How much that shifted there. And maybe, again, I didn't hear right before.
Yeah, we'll pick it up. Yuval, riff on that, if you mm-hmm. would, our self-understanding and how it may evolve.
Yes, it's a very interesting idea, Susan. There is a lot of evidence that we are losing our ability to pay attention. You were speaking about, I think, attention to the present moment. And indeed, this may be the greatest loss that humankind have suffered over the last few hundred years. As hunter-gatherers, we needed always to be supremely attentive to what is happening at the present moment, to be supremely attentive to the sensual world around us, of noises, of smells, of feelings, of sights. Otherwise, we couldn't survive. Today, more and more in this hyper-technological society, we don't need to pay attention to the present. We don't need to pay attention to the sensory field in order to survive. And we are losing this ability. We become more and more distracted. We never live in the present moment. And this is this is responsible, I think, for one of the greatest paradoxes of history, and that is that as we become more and more powerful, but we don't seem to become any happier. We are 1,000 times more powerful than our ancestors, but we don't seem to be 1,000 times happier than our ancestors. We hardly seem to be any happier at all. And I think one of the biggest reasons is that you can become extremely powerful by diverting your attention from the present moment to all kinds of future planning. But the sources of happiness, the deepest sources, always require attention to the reality here and now. And if you lose that, you are in a bad situation.
Yuval Noah Harari writes in conclusion that we are consequently wreaking havoc on our fellow animals and on the surrounding ecosystem, seeking little more than our own comfort and amusement, yet never finding satisfaction. And he asks, is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods, which he says we're becoming, who don't know what they want? We'll look at that. Ray in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Ray, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Yuval.
Hello.
I can fully envision a day in the future, and it may only be 100 or 200 years away, when machines and computers become self-aware. And once that happens, I think we are entering into a new era of evolution that could very well result in a human-machine hybrid for one and only reason, the self-preservation need to survive reason. You know, a human machine hybrid will probably be much better equipped to survive.
I think that's where you're pointing, Yuval. If survival is all we're looking for, do you agree, Yuval?
Yeah, I agree that this is certainly an option. And if this happens, it will be not only the greatest revolution in history, it will also be the greatest revolution ever in biology. After 4 billion years of evolution by natural selection, which remained always limited to the organic realm, all organisms, from the bacteria to the dinosaurs to us, always just made of organic compounds. If within the next few centuries we start seeing cyborgs, we start seeing beings which are part organic, part inorganic, this is basically the greatest revolution in the evolution of life for 4 billion years. And we will probably also see a shift from natural selection to intelligent design as the chief motor of evolution, but intelligent design not of some unknown god above the clouds, intelligent design of our doing and the doings of our computers and machines and whatever. But again, I think we should emphasize that these are only scenarios, possibilities we need to take into account. It's not a prophecy about the future. In fact, our ability to actually predict the future is becoming more and more constrained, more than ever before in history. Previously, say in the Middle Ages, it was quite easy to know how the world would look like in 50 years. It would look basically like it does today in terms of how a family structure of the job market of politics. Yes, one king could replace the other, but the job market would look roughly the same. Now, when you look 50 years to the future, nobody has the faintest clue of how the job market will be like. If a young person comes and asks, what should I study today in college so that I would have a good job in 30 years, in 40 years, nobody knows anything about what kind of jobs humans will do or what the job market or the economy would look like in 30, 40 years. So all these predictions about the future should be taken more as possible scenarios, an invitation to think about our choices today, not as prophecies for this is how it's going to be.
What an irony in terms of our present-day political or cultural discourse that you say that we're moving from natural selection, the way evolution has worked, to intelligent design, presuming we get some kind of super intelligence attached But you raise a lot of flags in your book, Yuval, about this future. We don't know where it's going. And you say we're essentially leaving it to market forces, that Google and others see a lot more about what's coming than our elected leaders do. Mm. How do you feel about the fact of market forces in charge of this, in evolutionary terms, light speed movement that we're making maybe toward the end of Homo sapiens?
I think it is very dangerous. It's troubling that you hear the politicians, whether in Washington or Jerusalem or anywhere else, and they are concerned about the problems of the present moment, about the crisis in the Middle East or the Ukraine or whatever, which is important, of course. But then you listen to the people in Silicon Valley, to people in places like Google. And as you mentioned, Ray Kurzweil have just recently been made one of the managers at Google. And they are thinking much more seriously about the really big questions facing humankind. Where is life going? They are thinking about issues like defeating death, like upgrading humans. And I find it troubling that the politicians are leaving these visions of the future simply in the hands of market forces. It's not that market forces are bad, but I think we need more than the blind hand of the market and the visions of people at the top of corporations to make the most important decisions in the history, not even of humanity, but of life in general.
Priscilla in Newton, Massachusetts. Priscilla, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, Tom. I wonder if towards the end of this discourse we can add a spiritual dimension to human evolution, that even with all the statistics and the very downbeat prognostications of the end of the Homo sapiens and we will all just be a footnote in the history of the universe, because we are not mechanistic or economic units and are not completely driven by market forces, what about the fact that there is the spiritual element, which I dare to say was also connected as well as advocated for by one of New England's foremost philosophers, Ralph Waldo Emerson, where he says in his essay, Nature, there is never a beginning, there is never an end to the inexplicable continuity of this web of God, but always circular power returning unto itself, which really predicates the fact that there is somewhere in the mystery of all this a spiritual landscape.
Priscilla, but if I may, Yuval is pointing to that. He calls that idea itself a fiction, to use the language of his book. He calls it an empowering fiction for Homo sapiens. But he looks at it, I'll let him speak to it, but he looks at it more or less as just a concept that's been empowering rather than a fact in itself. What do you say, Priscilla?
And maybe it's the one thing that will probably save us from the abyss, because in the end, between myths and stories and the power of human connection above and beyond our market value, we will actually keep ourselves from self-destruction.
Maybe so. Let us pick it up. Yuval, does story come back in to save us somehow here?
Well, first of all, about spirituality, I'll just give my two cents on the issue. I make a distinction between religion and spirituality. For me, religion is about answers, and spirituality is about questions, asking the questions. I think I'm a very spiritual person in the sense that I ask questions and I follow them wherever they take me. Religion, in my view, is where you have a story which gives an answer, and that's it. And you believe that story, and the question is over. And spirituality, in this sense, at least in my eyes, is the exact antithesis of religion. It's asking a very big question, like, who are we, or what are we doing here, what is the meaning of all this?
Does it save us from the kind of gloomy prognosis that you've got here, Priscilla asks?
Well, I think that, again, much of what we've talked about is about the negative potentials and negative activities of humankind. Perhaps we can add on a positive note and, again, take this one example of the decline of war over the last few generations to understand that humankind can do extremely good and beneficial things as well. We don't realize it often, but we are living in the most peaceful era ever. It's not that there is no war anymore. I come from the Middle East, so I know there are still wars, but less than ever before. And it's not just a question of statistics. For the first time in history, peace has acquired a new meaning. Throughout history, peace always meant the temporary absence of war. In 1913, if there is peace between France and Germany, everybody knows that this is just a temporary situation and war might erupt any minute, next year. Today, for the first time in history, there is real peace in the sense of the implausibility, the impossibility of war between many countries. When we say that there is peace between France and Germany, this is not a temporary situation. It's unthinkable that there is going to be a war between them, or between the United States and Canada, or between Argentina and Brazil. And this is for the first time in history we have this. And the responsibility, I think, is my best guess is the responsibility goes first of all to nuclear weapons, which made huge wars collective suicide, and secondly, market forces, which changed the nature of the economy.
Well, there's yet another story. A story around the idea of peace. I don't know, with Merkel and Obama today talking about Russia, I'm not sure of the durability on that front. You've given us a lot to think about on a very grand scale. Yuval Noah Harari, professor of world history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His book, just out in the U.S. this week, is Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. Professor Harari, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for listening.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.